everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. And today we're very privileged to have with us Professor Martin Kaplan, who is the most amazing guy because he's actually a gastroenterologist with the Royal Free in London and also in private practice at the Wellington Hospital. So first of all, it will be fascinating to hear about his experiences in this pandemic with COVID-19. But he's got some very interesting things to tell us about hop extract and its viral properties. So let's get started. So, Martin, you've let's start off at the beginning, which is, what's your experiences of COVID-19, if that's not a too bigger and broader question? So you've been working, obviously, with patients. I mean, have you had to stop what you've been doing because of COVID, or have you cracked on like normal?
Yes. So, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity of being here this evening and discussing with you. In terms of my practice, I'm a gastroenterologist, and I also have a practice in rare intestinal cancers. And so, certainly in March 2020, when things really kicked off, we saw that the gastroenterology outpatients completely ground to a halt because our staff were being seconded elsewhere to support ITU, to support the wards. And this had a big impact in that patients then weren't able to have their endoscopies. There's probably a lack of cancer diagnosis made in patients as a result. In terms of my cancer practice, we were desperately keen to try and maintain treatments for our patients who'd started their chemotherapy or some of the radioactive treatments that we do. And we were fortunate in that with the support of the trust and a lot of negotiating and as to why patients should continue to be treated and making sure that we stuck to appropriate treatment criteria, that we were able to continue to treat patients. But at one point, in terms of keeping the cancer service going, it was just me on my own. My nurses had been seconded to the wards, one to the Excel Centre. Other consultant colleagues were seconded to the medical wards as well. And so, and because it was all so new, there was this concentration of needing the extra staff and making sure we always had backup, and which probably impacted on all the medical services other than COVID in a negative way. And as time went on, there was a better understanding of COVID and the processes and the management. I think I've been immensely proud of the Royal Free Hospital, from everybody, from the senior management to medical colleagues, fantastic nursing colleagues, and you know, you have to take into account how extra cleaning and all of the basic work that goes on. And this second time round, if you like, with the resurgence of the virus, we've known what to expect, and the treatments have evolved as well, so that we're managing patients, I think, better in terms of get earlier steroids if their oxygen saturations are dropping. They'll get appropriate new treatments that are out as well. And it was interesting, in the first time round, they saw me as being, oh, you're getting on a bit, just stay away from the very front line. And I would just be occasionally seeing our gastroenterology or cancer patients who had COVID and casualty, but they were keeping me back just in case, as I was in my later 50s, that I might be at higher risk. But the second time round, they said, just get on with it, Kaplan. You can go to ITU
They
chucked me in this time round, which was actually good. And in fact, it was very interesting in terms of what one was experienced this time compared to last time on ITU, where you just saw areas of the hospital which were not designated to be ITUs were now intensive care units, whether it's surgical theatre, surgical recovery, and seeing how the staff were coping and doing such a great job for the patients. And what struck me initially was when you've got rows of patients who are on ventilators, that you have to keep in mind that these are people with families, and particularly when they're not getting relatives in there, and you're trying to maintain some contact in terms of keeping families informed, but you've got patients who are sedated and ventilated. And it's very important for the care of that patient, but for their family to know that, they're being treated as members of families and parents, brothers, sisters, and so on. But in many ways, it can be quite hard at times. And I think that can be quite stressful for those caring for the patients. And it is a big effort. And what I, as a gastroenterologist this time round, I suppose on ITU I was involved a little bit more with patients because of their anticoagulators. They're on blood thinners, many patients, because now of the higher risk of getting pulmonary emboli, so clots in the lung and so on. And you want to make sure the circulation is good, but that would lead to other complications. So you might have a higher risk of ulcer bleeding or intestinal bleeding for one cause or another, which would mean that one was needing to do endoscopies. And also, relevant to you is that patients were getting not only parenteral nutrition, so intravenous feeding, but also nasogastric or nasojejunal feeding. And so one was often putting down nasojejunal tubes to optimize the feeding that they were getting, because the gut being stimulated with nutrition is important, not only from the calorie intake, but also stimulating the immune system. And I think it's been very well coordinated this time overall, the overall management, I think, of patients. We understand the disease better. There's more treatment options that we can consider. And it's not quite so unknown and frightening from that perspective as well. So my take on it is, and also seeing, surgeons who are high-powered surgeons who would just be, because they're not able to do a normal operating list because of their theatres taken over by coronavirus patients on IT ventilators, they were there helping proning the patients and just turning patients and doing manual jobs, because it's manual care which is so important.
So everybody's sort of pitched in, which is lovely, yeah. Actually, isn't it? I mean, that sort of hierarchy thing, which, obviously, can be very cultural, can't it? We were just chatting before, about the culture of medicine. It can be sort of that very cultural thing, which would say, oh, no, I'm far too grand to do that. But it seems like everybody's...
The positives that come out of this is you want to break down the hierarchy. Everyone's part of this team, and in many respects, it's a sort of war effort where everyone has to come together. And yes, there has to be leadership at the right points, but actually, if you're there and you need to help turn a patient, doesn't matter who you are, anyone can do it, whether you're some grand surgeon or a professor or whatever, everyone can pitch in, and that attitude I think was good. And that hopefully there's lessons learned for the future in that as well, in terms of the way we do work, and that's what comes out of this as well.
So are you seeing now that you ventilate patients less? Because I know, of course, it was a thing at the beginning. I mean, obviously, because people thought it was this is what I'm gathering from the news, so you'll have to correct me if I'm totally wrong, but that it was, a lung infection in effect, or a lung issue. But so are you seeing that actually, the ventilation is one of the last strategies now, because you're able to put these other steroid protocols in,
so the patients were needing to end up on ventilators. I suppose I'm no expert. I'm not an anaesthetist. I'm no expert as such in COVID. I'm a mere gastroenterologist. But my impression is that a lot of the lung inflammation is due to the virus releasing these cytokines, the severe inflammatory response, it's called a cytokine storm, which actually would cause inflammation in the lung and make it more difficult to aerate the lung, and so the oxygen saturations would drop, and it would get to a critical point where then patients would need to be ventilated. And the benefit of steroids, dexamethasone in the studies, is that you could reduce that inflammatory component by using the dexamethasone as an earlier stage. There are other drugs that one sees now in the news coming through, which also damp the immune system, this immune response, so that you don't get such a severe reaction in the lungs. And it's quite interesting that these are drugs which were used to dampen the immune system in conditions such as rheumatoid arthritis, and they're being trialed and used now in COVID-19 on the high dependency units or intensive care units. So it's quite interesting from that perspective.
Do you know if they're using, I mean, sort of getting on to the sort of nutritional side and what your passion is in a way, I suppose, is do you know if they were using vitamin C protocols?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question and topical in terms of vitamin C, and quite controversial still in some respects. But, you know, vitamin C is very interesting in terms of, I'm sure many of the people on listening tonight will be recommending vitamin C. And vitamin C has been shown historically to, against common cold, to reduce the risk of getting the common cold. Doesn't necessarily then, once you've got it, have a great impact. But what was interesting is in terms of high-dose vitamin C, there'd been a number of papers in critical care journals actually published in the last 2 years where patients who received high-dose intravenous vitamin C had a lower mortality related to severe sepsis. And as a result of that, that data was really quite robust. And so out of that, there's been a clinical trial of intravenous vitamin C in patients with COVID-19. And that's giving a high dose intravenous vitamin C. The results are awaited. But it's thought that it works via its antioxidant and anti-inflammatory effects and reducing this cytokine storm. And if you have a look at countries where there's high vitamin C in the population in terms of the measured blood profiles, it's much higher in Germany, for example, than in the UK. Whatever it is in the German food, the black population have higher levels of vitamin C, very, very interestingly. So I think there's definitely something there, and particularly in patients with severe sepsis. We know there's a New Zealand study published last year which showed in pneumonia that patients who had low levels of vitamin C had worse outcomes. So, you know, there is evidence there in terms of vitamin C, and I think it's got some merits. We need to prove it in bigger studies, but you know, there's a big study in Barcelona from, was it last year, where they showed that in patients who had vitamin C supplemented, their levels were low. Again, they had, and this is again in a different setting on ITU in Barcelona, they had worse outcomes if you had very low levels of vitamin C and high mortality. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for vitamin C, is the bottom line. We need more evidence, but something that has benefits in this situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely interesting. And of course, there's the vitamin D thing before we get on to talk about what we're talking about, really. But I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Suppose, again, you know, you've got the government are talking up vitamin D. And again, you know, the outcome for patients with low vitamin D is worse than patients with high vitamin D. And so looking, you know, you could argue, actually, that patients might have their blood levels checked, or you just take vitamin D because we know that that there is a protective effect of vitamin D. There's another study from Barcelona again last year, which was a really interesting study because it was looking, you know, Spain had many thousands and thousands of patients, as you know, with severe coronavirus on the intensive care units, and they looked at, it was over 900 patients on the intensive care unit. They gave, I think half of them got a vitamin D supplement, and then those who ended up being ventilated on ITU, I think it was 5% of the group who had the vitamin D supplement and 20% of the group who didn't get the vitamin D supplement in this randomized trial into the two. So there did seem to be a clear benefit of vitamin D in severely ill patients, and there was a lower mortality in that group as well. And it looks as though vitamin D and probably other vitamins affect the binding of the virus into the cells, so that if I always think of it as the in terms of this, you've got the space station and you've got the shuttle that's docking with the space station, and then they open the door and the astronaut comes in, and that's the virus sort of coming into the space station and causing havoc. But and if you think that you've got vitamin D or even zinc, which can sort of prevent the binding of that space shuttle to the space station, so that's the spike protein binding to the cells, then that seems to be part of this mechanism. It's called the angiotensin converting enzyme receptor. So it's really interesting how vitamin D, zinc, and all of and vitamin C have an impact on that process, on this ACE levels and receptor levels. And what's also, finally, before I bore everyone completely, is is the genetic differences as well, because the vitamin D status is often lower in Asian, Black, mixed ethnicity communities compared to white ethnicities, and there appears to be some genetic mutations which affect then the way that vitamin D binds, and then and the way then that individuals cope with low vitamin D levels, and that impacts on the virus. So it's actually a very interesting area which will come out more and more from people now having collected blood and looking at levels of vitamin D and zinc and so on. And then you've got, you know, similar story for zinc. And then the other one, which is topical, is I think selenium, which is also quite... There's been studies that came out of China that showed that patients with low selenium levels did worse, and you can measure selenium from hair samples as well as blood samples. But what was particularly interesting is that selenium deficiency, and there's an interaction of selenium in the way that viruses can mutate, and there seems to be a high mutation rate in patients who have deficiencies in selenium, and at this time when we're all worried about the South African version of the virus because it mutates more, then there is data that goes back many years on terms of selenium deficiency and patients then being more prone to having mutations of viruses, and I think there's a whole area that needs to be understood from minerals and vitamins, and hopefully this whole area of nutrition will really come to the fore in these coming years as a result of COVID-19, and also the importance of it, because you know what, if you can advise people to take vitamin D, take zinc, or vitamin C, selenium, then there's a lot to be said for that, and you want to have the evidence base to be able to advise that. And there are definite benefits there, not so well understood. Just as a gastroenterologist, I have a sort of interest in this and minerals, but not so well understood generally. It's not so topical for in medicine, but yet really important, because it may be a way of just making sure everyone's got their vitamin D, vitamin C levels on board, or that having good mineral levels, vitamin levels may help abrogate the course of the virus. So I think it's very interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you, as you so rightly point out there, it's kind of almost like, as people interested in nutrition, we've kind of known this for a long time, but it's kind of like that motivation, isn't it, really, which is, it's kind of fear in a way that says, oh my goodness, what are the solutions? Oh, there's these studies. Oh, this suddenly becomes highlighted. Whereas actually, arguably the problem, or at least the advantageous situation that the virus takes, the situation that the virus takes advantage of is in effect poor health and poor diet. Loads of other, it's what Richard Horton from The Lancet calls it, or he didn't call it actually, an anthropologist called it a syndemic, looking at this kind of like it's not a pandemic, it's a syndemic, meaning there's lots of different underlying kind of triggers and causes that then causes problems, from cities to poor diet to inequality to, as you say, people of colour who are being unfairly targeted due to vitamin D status, a whole lot of other stuff. It's kind of a complex web of reasons rather than just the reaction to a virus. But, meaning, I suppose the sexy kind of cure for the virus is biomedicine, the sort of like, let's find a drug, let's find a vaccine, let's find whatever, rather than looking at these more basic things like vitamin D, and which are cheap, after all.
Absolutely. And if so, we know that it's often the poorest sectors of society which are hardest hit, and it may well be because actually they haven't been able to have such good nutrition, and also they haven't being able to have sort of the optimal medical care or exposure to the right treatments at the right time, whether that be better diabetic control, cholesterol control, or whatever it is. There's a lot of factors there, and a lot of it relates to nutrition.
Well, let's get on to, by way of talking, we're going to talk hop extract today, but I just want to understand how you got involved with UltraVita and how you got involved with kind of what we would call the other side, sort of in a way that we don't, it's wonderful, but we don't expect somebody as a professor such as yourself involved with all sorts of amazing, you can go to the website, everybody, and read Professor Kaplan's biography, which it runs into several pages of amazement, but which I'm sure he's much too modest to mention here, but it's kind of like, actually, it's incredible that you see things in a much more rounded way. So was there an involvement into this thinking, or how did that happen?
Yeah, no, it was, as ever, just listening to patients, and I'm very traditional, sort of boring gastroenterologist of traditionally thinking, but actually I've never been quite the traditionalist in many respects, and I think the more if you follow the same processes all the time, then everything just stays the same. You have to be questioning to make advances, and I suppose that's always been at the back of my mind. And also just to listen to anyone, listen to people, listen to patients, and just having an open mind. And so, largely from the gastroenterology practice, but also my cancer practice, I was seeing lots of patients who would come in, and they would say, "Oh, I've been to my nutritionist, and And let me tell you, it's medicine's quite snobby. And when we were medical students, nutritionists would be belittled in terms of some quack type of process. And you know, there's an amazing ignorance out there in the medicine world. And even with time, it's slowly getting better, but only slowly. And so, you know, I do discuss with my medical students actually. And the role of much more of nutritional supplements and the role that nutritionists play in looking after the welfare of patients. And I'd have many of my patients, particularly the cancer patients, would be taking lots of different supplements. And I didn't know anything about them. And whether that be curcumin, green tea, adding in some zinc, whatever it was. And so I thought, well, I need to do something about this. And with some of our research fellows and dietitian, in fact, as well, looked at the evidence base. And actually, we published in peer-reviewed journals the role of diet and supplements in a whole range of cancers. So we wrote a paper on colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate, and so on. And I was fascinated by all of this, and you saw this evidence, you saw the evidence for supporting vitamin D, you saw the role for curcumin and anti-tumor effects, anti-inflammatory effects, and then there was Professor Will Stewart in Leicester who was doing, had a whole clinical, a preclinical research network of studies of curcumin in combination with chemotherapy in colon cancer, and then translating that into clinical trial. And so you just think, oh, there's a lot more to this, and Ayurvedic medicine has been around for hundreds and thousands of years, and there must be a reason why it survives. And so I was increasingly intrigued, and then we also wrote a paper in terms of from gastroenterology inflammatory bowel disease, saying that, well, actually there were randomized trials of curcumin and green tea and vitamin D, separate trials showing the benefit in patients with ulcerative colitis. So, you know, this was increasingly getting my attention and looking to try and create an evidence base. And so a friend of mine who was a very philanthropic person, I said, look, part of the problem is, and nutritionists I think will know this more than anyone, there's a great variety in the quality of supplements out there. And I said, look, it'd be quite nice, and I was very naive, to say, well, to have a series of supplements that could be targeted for different conditions. So, and I became a medical advisor to this company, which was first of all called Profbiotics. It's a ridiculous name because they thought, oh, we'll have a professor behind it, we'll call it Profbiotics, as he's got a good medical chap behind it. Of course, everyone confused it with probiotics, and it was all rather poor. And then one thought, well, you could be recommending. So we had written these papers on vitamin D, saying curcumin's beneficial, how to cook food and so on, you shouldn't be burning food and the increased risks related to all of that, and in terms of cellular turnover and creating dysplasia and potential cancer. And so my advice is set up these supplements for each type of condition, colon, breast, and so on. But of course, actually you're not allowed to, so then, of course, you're not allowed to make any claims or say anything about that, quite rightly. But that was, Michael, who set up this company, was amazingly understanding and saying, well, we're doing good because at least we're trying to create good quality supplements and so on. But actually what happened was that that company changed its name to Altravita to try and maintain what was evidence-based practice, and I still act as a medical advisor to them. There's a nutritionist and dietitian involved as well, to try and have published papers, but also to have good quality products. And So that side of things has been going forward, and as part of all of this, and then this whole area of trying to understand supplements in more detail, I was intrigued. I was examining a researcher in the States, and he was doing research on. I'm getting now to answer your question: how did you get into hops? So he was doing research into the hop extract called xanthohumol, and this is about 8 years ago. And xanthohumol he had shown in his research was having anti-tumor effect in the rare cancers that I was involved with. And this data looked very interesting in terms of it's all in vitro and cell culture and so on. But I thought, well, this is really intriguing. And then the more one read up about this hop extract, xanthohumol, the more one saw the evidence for anti-inflammatory, it's probably one of the strongest antioxidants and anti-inflammatory agents naturally out there. And so I was intrigued by this and just kept an eye on xanthohumol. And we had then, there were some papers where it was looking at diabetic control, obesity, hyperlipidemia, where actually the hop extract, xanthohumol, was very beneficial in that area. And so we wrote a paper 2 years ago on metabolic control and benefits of xanthohumol in patients with hyperlipidemia, obesity, type 2 diabetes mellitus. Now, the problem one has is that it's based on largely cell culture and then animal data, but not a great deal related to human data, because actually to do the clinical trials, you often need big pharma behind you. And that's the problem with all of the sort of natural treatments, is that if you haven't got the millions and millions of pounds of big pharma behind you, and you haven't got a sexy name to a drug, and you've just got a generic, something generic out there, whether it's curcumin or whatever, it's difficult to often do those trials. But so xanthohumol was taking my interest all the time in its beneficial metabolic aspects. And then lo and behold, we had COVID-19, and I was thinking, well, there must be ways of helping in terms of whether it's vitamins, and as we've already discussed. And then I saw that there was some papers, in fact, that came out of China of xanthohumol in a very interesting series. It was a whole series of papers, actually, looking at xanthohumol across different viruses, and it has antiviral properties against cytomegalovirus, herpes, simplex virus 1 and 2, and different RNA and DNA viruses, which made one think, well, you know, this looks ever more interesting. And there's a very similar virus called porcine respiratory virus, which, as the name suggests, affects pigs. And this virus was knocking off and killing lots of pigs across America and China. And this virus is rather similar. It's a single-stranded RNA virus, not so dissimilar to the coronavirus. And these pigs were presenting with high fever, high death rates. They had this severe respiratory disease with the cytokine storm that you were seeing in humans with COVID-19. So there were papers then looking at the role of xanthohumol in this PRRSV, this porcine virus, and they had shown in cell culture, but also in pigs, that actually it was able to reduce virus. Giving xanthohumol was able to reduce virus levels significantly, and it also reduced this cytokine storm causing the inflammation in the lungs. You looked at the post-mortem studies on pigs who had received the xanthohumol, and you saw that compared to those pigs that hadn't, there was you could see beneficial effects of xanthohumol on the lungs, and they'd measured viral levels and so on, and thought, well, this is all very interesting in terms of the antiviral properties. And then one can then the more you look into this, then one saw the effect of xanthohumol and other virus, hepatitis C, in experimental situations. It's been shown that xanthohumol could reduce hepatitis C virus replication, and also that it would reduce the inflammation in the liver by reducing the cytokine pathways, anti-inflammatory pathways in the liver. So then I thought, well, actually...
Was that on a very high dose, Martin?
Or so that's the question. That's that. You're 100% right. That's the big question, is what dose do you need to do that? And in the cell culture model, it is high doses. In the pig treatment, it looked to be high doses. But then I was thinking, well, this is interesting, because then there was a paper actually which was published just a couple of years ago, which looked at giving humans xanthohumol and measuring levels in the blood. And they showed that 20 milligrams of xanthohumol, which isn't a massive dose at all, is able to cause good levels of circulating xanthohumol in the blood. And interesting that there's a group in Portland, Oregon now who have got registered with the FDA early phase metabolic studies with xanthohumol, looking at following the pharmacokinetics, but also the just the how long it stays in the blood and this sort of thing. And so that actually is really encouraging, that there are people out there who are interested in that, and that there's more human data coming through. But there doesn't seem to be, in the human data that's been published so far, there doesn't appear to be any toxicity related to xanthohumol. And so I'd asked my friend Michael and Altravita to get some xanthohumol, just so that in case anyone wanted it, that they could be taking it. I have to say, I then did a trial on myself, saying, well, how much of the xanthohumol? We had a capsule, which was 20 milligrams. Was there any toxicity? There's no known toxicity. So I was taking sort of 15 xanthohumol. I'm not recommending anyone does it, but 15 in a day, just to see if there was going to be any side effects. Because then I was proposing this to the research committee, saying, well, actually, maybe we could consider doing a clinical trial of xanthohumol in COVID patients. And so I was taking it at very high levels just to see. And there was, as far as I can tell, I'm still normal, and there hadn't been any untoward effects. And in fact, our family or whatever have all been taking the xanthohumol, and anecdotally, none of us had picked up a coronavirus. But also there was other benefits as well, that for which one was recommending the xanthohumol. And so one had proposed, we got through one of the COVID research committees at the Royal Free, and the question of then was, what's the dosage and can you do clinical trials? But we got as far as then being taken serious by the NHS, but parked in this list of however many trials there are waiting within the NHS. And of course, because there's no big pharma behind it, and there's a certain thing, well, it's, what's this food supplement? You know, is it really? It's a food supplement. It can't be any good. You have to get over that mentality that something like that could be worthwhile. And so, but at the Crick Institute, there, which is the premier researchers into COVID-19, they're doing some preliminary studies in COVID-19 infected cells, and the initial pilot study, which is the only data we have, had shown non-specific beneficial effects of xanthohumol in preventing binding of virus to cells, probably. But again, it's parked in a whole queue of other research priorities that are there, and it would take some time to get to be able to get the preclinical data, and ideally to do have the clinical data. But it certainly has opened my eyes to, one, there's a clear antiviral effect that's been demonstrated in similar virus infections, and it has the benefit, the important benefit of the anti-cytokine, anti-inflammatory effect, and potentially then being able to abrogate this cytokine storm. So as a hypothesis, I actually published that in a journal a few months ago as well, just to try and get other people interested in those properties, and that, and certainly we had discussions with a group from Yale who are interested in the whole virus area and looking at other ways forward. So one hopes that we could get to clinical trials, but actually in the first instance, if I've got patients there, and I'd say, well, actually, there's benefit of the xanthohumol because actually it's good for the metabolic side of things. We know that obesity and poor diabetic control are bad prognosticators in COVID-19. It appears to have antiviral effects, and so why not take it until it's not doing any harm and maybe doing you some good. So until we get some proper clinical trial data, I don't see any harm in taking it, but one would like to have a more robust way forward. And that's the difficulty that I see in a lot of natural medicines, is that you're fighting against the common perception of people's stereotypes of what they think about natural medicines, and also, and they forget that, you know, digoxin, the famous drug for atrial fibrillation, is derived from the plant digitoxin, digitalis, and it's all derived from all of this. And it's people forget how drugs are formed, but it's all about...
Well, also, they usually have a one effect, don't they? And that's the issue with a lot of drugs, which is their targeted effect, whereas a lot of plant medicines and general medicines, as you were discussing with the HOP, it's not just about the virus. It's about anti-inflammatory. It's about modulating loads of other, factors, if you like. So it's kind of interesting. It has that sort of systemic effect, which I think in this sort of age of technology, it's kind of like, sort of almost like you have to push one button and that has to have one result. I don't think people understand about systems. I mean, systems medicine and systems generally. I mean, it's very, very targeted. Mm. And, that's a mindset thing. As you say, it's quite difficult. It's quite difficult to get over that, because I think the glory is, isn't it, with people making money, a lot of money out of drugs. And unfortunately, again, we're talking about Richard Horton. I think he was somebody who highlighted, there is an issue with bias in medicine from pharmaceutical kind of dollars, if you like. So, it's a huge cultural thing to get round and over, because you're going to listen to the loudest voices.
And of course, there's so little funding available for research generally that a lot of that research comes from Big Pharma. Now, in terms of the funding, it comes from Big Pharma to whether it be universities or whatever. I work very closely, don't get me wrong, I work very closely with Pharma, and they have a very positive role to play, but also you have to find where you draw the line as well.
It has to be balanced, doesn't it? Absolutely. I mean, it's not that it's not valid. There's plenty of, reasons to celebrate, even as a nutritionist, there's plenty of reasons to celebrate some drugs, absolutely. But but unfortunately, I think the sort of weight of the scales is just so far onto the one side, as opposed to looking at these other much, and as I say, they're systems issues, like diet, lifestyle, but they're sort of rather woolly in terms of if you're trying to actually pin it down, really. So, you know, that's the big problem. They're kind of like, oh, do some exercise, eat well, you know, get some fresh air, make sure you live in a community and speak to people. They sort of seem a little bit ineffectual, you know, because you can't really measure them, I suppose, in black and white.
Yes, and I think, it's exactly, and it's about educating the people who currently think like that, who think is all woolly and so on. So I do try and sort of teach my medical students, but I suspect I'm in the minority in terms of doing that and saying, you know, that holistic approach and looking at, you know, what could be out there in terms of natural supplements and, you know, the role that the nutritionists play and in terms of supporting the patients and, you know, because that's the real world. And you might have your textbooks there. You've also got to be able to apply that to the real world and understand how it works for the patients and what the patients are wanting. And so then you want to see if you can just get that symbiosis between both the both sides of that.
Well, I think the thing is as well, isn't it? I mean, obviously you would know this much more than me, but I mean, my sort of guess is that patients might be coming a bit more sort of educated, a bit more cheeky than they were before, which is they might have done some research on Dr. Google, you know, the dreaded Dr. Google, and, you know, they come in with a certain, you know, might come in, or certain patients are going to come in with a certain degree of knowledge. And actually, you lose the patient, in effect, if you just dismiss that, as you alluded to at the beginning of this conversation. Do you know what I mean? If you just go, oh, don't be ridiculous. And when they've done the research, they seem to feel better. You know, who are we to argue with that, really? So, I mean, anecdotally, have you seen benefit from, obviously, from the receptive patients who you do encourage to change lifestyle and take some supplements? And do you see difference in that, you know, versus somebody who really just wants you to go in and kind of sew them all up and make the repairs?
Yes, I do believe, I you know, it is anecdotal, but I really believe actually it is that whole approach, and I believe that that actually patients taking the right supplements, I think there is a benefit to them, and I think that there is I truly believe that there is a metabolic benefit for the right supplements for the right patients, and as you know, it is an individual thing as well, in terms of you give too much of vitamin C or whatever to someone, you might make them toxic and you might cause other problems. And so also, I don't know if you look at vitamin E levels in prostate cancer versus pancreatic cancer, there can be different outcomes in terms of how good it is for one and not so good for another potentially. And I think trying to understand that individual patient, why they need a supplement is important, and just having that general knowledge of it and trying to, you know, I would be measuring levels on patients for whether it's selenium, whether it's you know, you can measure lycopene levels in patients, and they show that low lycopene levels had a worse outcome in breast cancer, for example. So, you know, there's a lot that can be done, but it's expensive to do blood tests and so on. But at least we should be looking to understand this. Certainly, anecdotally, I believe that there is a benefit, and I think that where I've recommended such supplements to patients, that they've generally have benefited from it. And I think where in ulcerative colitis, where I have recommended curcumin, vitamin D, green tea, combination capsule in those patients, particularly ones who've been intolerant of other medications or have having recurrent course of steroids, I believe that that we've been able to reduce the amount of steroids they've needed to take. So I think that there are definite benefits there. I'd love to be able to do the big clinical trials, but the reality is it's going to be difficult, whether it be for COVID or inflammatory bowel disease, just because when you've got generic compounds, and don't forget the beauty of whether it's xanthohumol is that actually any country could do it. It's a hop extract. It's readily available. And, you know, it's cheaper anywhere. You could do that in any country. And
is some Sorry to interrupt. I was going to say, is dengue, viral?
Yeah.
Dengue fever. Yeah, that's interesting because I have a friend who lives in Bali, lucky devil. And she was saying, obviously, the big, big issue was dengue fever. I mean, COVID is like, obviously, COVID has hit them in terms of this cultural aspect of what's happened in the whole world. But the big problem, of course, is a bigger problem for them, which is dengue fever. She went down with dengue fever. So interesting. You know, I'll tell her about this for sure. That would be interesting because obviously if it's quite cost effective, somewhere like Bali, where, you know, they don't have the budget for drugs, it's quite an interesting prospect. Yeah, yeah.
Even vitamin D levels and so on, all important in dengue fever and, it's actually simple interventions which might have major impact.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. I was going to say something more. Oh, it's just one more sort of parting comment because we've come to the top of the hour so quickly. But I'm always fascinated in this, which is what do your other colleagues think of you as somebody who kind of delves in this rather unfashionable area of intervention?
I suppose I got warned off actually by a senior colleague of mine who said, Martin, you're crazy to be going down this route. It won't be seen well in the university and it could affect your position and this sort of thing. And I thought, oh my goodness. And so I've been incredibly sensitive to it and I've always tried to purvey anything that I say in terms of evidence base as a result, but and I suppose because I'm old enough and I suppose I'm confident of where I'm at, I'm able to speak out a bit more and discuss with students and so on, but actually that there is this incredible bias out there against sort of this type of consideration, which I in terms of natural meds and diet and the role in that nutritionists play, and I think there's a lot of work to be done. I'm sensitive to that, I just see myself. Someone has to be able to speak up about it as well, because I believe that. There is a benefit to patients by just these simple nutritional interventions, and that's what it's all about, is ultimately trying to help the patient. And actually it's often those smaller interventions we said at the very beginning, if you can improve diet with patients, then those patients who are in the lower echelons of this in terms of society but are much more prone to disease might have a better chance in terms of reducing disease burden and this sort of thing.
Well, yes, and on that hopeful note, I think it's about changing culture sort of gently,
yeah,
as opposed to coming,
absolutely.
You know, like, it's, yeah, I mean, you have to speak the same language. If you're bucking up against, you know, I suppose, you know, this culture clash, if you like, then of course it's really not helpful. To really just little by little and evidence based, as you say, and in a one way, of course, this, you know, like natural medicine obviously has a long history of this, these anecdotal effects and it's sort of unarguable truth sometimes, you might think, but of course that's not what we're trying to deal with. You have to deal with the evidence based approach, otherwise you just lose your audience, so to speak.
Yes.
So I completely understand your approach and thank you for it. So basically let's I'd love to have you back, Martin, when it's very interesting to hear about those COVID experiences at the beginning of our session today. So finally, I missed, and probably you said, But is the actual, what is the actual supplement called from Ultravita? Is it just hopper extract, or is it called something particular that we should have a look at?
Exciting as xanthohumol. It's just called, it's called
xanthohumol. Right.
Yeah, it's just out there as generic xanthohumol.
We can look that up, and thank you very much. I'm going to immediately tell my friends in Bali about this. So thank you so much for your time today, and we'll have you back very soon. So thank you very much, Professor Martin Kaplan, and what a fascinating talk. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much as well, Kate.
All right, go well.
Bye-bye.